Welcome to Talking History. I am Richard Hamm, and I am interviewing Timothy J. Guilfoyle, author of City of Eros. We'll be talking about Professor Guilfoyle's book, City of Eros, and his new project, which is a study of the New York underworld in roughly the same period, the late 19th and early 20th century. So, Tim, how did you become interested in the subject of prostitution?
My interest in prostitution actually was more out of an interest in urban planning and the physical development of cities, specifically New York, and specifically in the 19th century. I was intrigued by how red light districts moved around the city over the course of the course of the 19th century, and I was familiar enough with the literature that there was quite a bit of discussion in the 19th century on prostitution, but not a very serious study on the part of historians. And so this interest that I had in urban planning and physical development of the city, combined with an interest in the history of sexuality, made prostitution an ideal topic of study for me. I actually first came across the idea, interestingly enough and ironically enough, after reading a book of one of your colleagues here at SUNY Albany, Robert Dykstra's The Cattle Towns. He has a small section in that volume where he describes how the various cattle towns in Kansas, the founding fathers, if you want to call them that, would actually organize brothels on the outskirts of town for the various cattlemen as they were coming through in the period after the Civil War. And it was highly organized, highly visible. Nobody made any effort to try and conceal the activity. And that blatancy, in some sense, inspired me to think a little bit about New York and how New York was different or perhaps similar in some ways to what he described in the cattle towns of Kansas. And that's what spurred me into investigating the subject and eventually led to the writing of City of Eros. So it really began as a study to look at the physical history, physical geography, the moral geography of New York, and it evolved into a larger study that looks at the cultural and social history of sexuality in New York.
Yeah, actually, in this period in New York, from 1820 to 1920, you talk about whoredom's golden century. And what do you mean by this period of the whorearchy, as you called it in another place?
Well, the whorearchy was actually a term that was used by George Templeton Strong, the famous diarist in the 19th century, in reference to the visibility, the blatant presence of prostitution on New York's major streets, like Broadway, the Bowery, 14th Street, and other places like that during the course of the 19th century. And he referred to the visible presence in almost the same way that you would refer to different classes or ethnic groups or various social groups in New York. And I focus on the period from 1820 to 1920 because that's really the period where prostitution was the most visible and was distinctive from what existed prior to 1820, specifically from the end of the Revolution up to really the opening of the Erie Canal and the rapid growth of New York up to World War I. Prior to 1820, 1830, prostitution was largely segregated or confined to a few neighborhoods, usually along the dockfront areas. It was fairly physically, geographically segregated and marginalized and was really not a visible presence. Even travelers from Europe to New York noted how, in comparison to the leading cities of Europe, prostitution just simply wasn't as visible in Gotham. And after 1820, you start to see a physical explosion of the number of brothels and the vast display of prostitutes walking the streets, the various kinds of entertainments, concert saloons, tableau vivant shows, model artist shows that are staged in various parts of the leisure districts of the city. And that continues really throughout much of the 19th century. And around World War I, there's an effort to try and push prostitution underground to make it less visible. And that's when I end my study, because I think it begins, prostitution enters a new phase at that point, which really requires another volume by probably another historian sometime in the future.
Well, in the century of prostitution, in its golden age, You said it's also marked by the men who frequent the prostitutes belong to a sporting male culture. What do you mean by a sporting male culture, and how pervasive was this culture, and you know, how is it rooted socioeconomically and culturally in New York City?
Well, the sporting male subculture is a phenomenon that develops sometime in the 1820s. There's elements of it that predate that period, but it starts to come to fruition during the antebellum period through a variety of forces. One is the decline of the boarding house, the decline of the craft system, the decline of traditional familial and church controls over the behavior of young men. Increasingly, young men are migrating to the city. They're living on their own in boarding houses. They're working as clerks or in some other kind of independent wage labor. They're not in a craft situation whereby the master would supervise his apprentice and keep a watchful eye over his behavior and train him in the secrets of the craft and monitor his moral behavior as well. The new kind of industrialization that's taking place in the city, as well as even in the financial service sector, separates that relationship between the old master craftsmen and their employees or apprentices. And as a consequence, young men have a lot more freedom, or at least the lack of traditional familial church and master control. And as a consequence, they tend to socialize more with their peers, less with their elders. And over the course of the 19th century, they develop their own distinctive peer subculture that's organized around saloons, brothels, sometimes gambling dens. And even within this, there's certain differences. There's different kinds, for example, of brothels. There's two broad categories that I think best describe how brothels were organized in the 19th century, both of which affect this sporting male subculture. On one hand, you would have private or parlor houses that tended to be more upscale, more expensive. You'd have to pay at least probably $5 to gain entrance into the house, which was a considerable sum of money back when workers earned anywhere from $6 to $16 a week. So it was hard to get into these houses if you didn't have money. Inside, they tended to replicate the physical arrangement of the middle-class Victorian household. There was an emphasis on privacy. You oftentimes couldn't get admitted unless you had a recommendation or had a reference that would allow you to gain admittance. And so there was a much stronger emphasis on privacy and organized around the traditional parlor house. In contrast to that, there were what would best be called public houses, whereby anybody could gain admittance as long as they were willing to pay whatever it costs to get in. And these tended to be cheaper. They tended to have more women working in the house. You would oftentimes have men lined up outside, developed into a kind of raucous, loud environment. Men would go in and come out very quickly, so it provided little more than genital gratification. And so you had these two elements within the sporting male culture that in some ways reflected the class structure that was emerging among 19th century New Yorkers, with middle class men being able to afford the well-to-do parlor houses or private houses and more working class men being forced into the more public, cheaper houses.
But sometimes the working class men would want to go into the parlor house and insist upon their sexual rights, I suppose.
That happens quite frequently, especially during the 1830s. There's large numbers of what I call brothel riots, for lack of a better term, incidents where gangs of men, sometimes organized, sometimes almost spontaneous, it seems. The evidence is a little unclear in that regard, would break into a house, knock on the door, push it in, sometimes attack the women involved, destroy some of the furniture, destroy the glassware and chinaware. It's hard to know exactly what their motivations were, but it seems that they generally focused on some of the well-to-do parlor houses, women who were prominent in this world, who were rather successful, accumulating fairly large sums of money, sometimes as much as $20,000 worth of property, which was an enormous sum of money in the 19th century. And in many cases, some of the women were identified and attacked for, it seems, because of their successful entrepreneurial enterprises. And there were some fairly significant individuals involved in some of these brothel riots. The most notable would have been Tom Heyer, who was a well-known gang leader, a butcher, who eventually went on to become one of the earliest heavyweight boxing champions in the United States, and eventually died of, not surprisingly, cirrhosis of the liver, which is probably a common end for many of those involved in the sporting male underworld.
But the women were not defenseless in these houses. I mean, this is one of the richnesses of your book. You say these men burst in, they trash the house, and the women respond by going to law.
Right. That's one of the interesting elements of the story. And in some ways, it's the reason that women try to assert themselves or protect themselves or at least protect their property by bringing these men to court is what provides a record for us to actually examine this bit of history, because otherwise there's the records on prostitution, especially in the antebellum period, are very poor. And in many cases, when these brothel riots occurred, they would bring charges to the district attorney for a violation of their property rights, for the destruction of their personal wares, and would actually prosecute the various men that were involved. And so we have a pretty detailed record still sitting there in the New York City Municipal Archives, where you have lists of men who were engaged in these attacks with addresses and details about the circumstances concerning the brothel riots. But more importantly for our discussion here is that it's a reflection of how men and women, in a sense, were in a state of tension over the role and the visibility of prostitution, that men resented on some level the success of many of the most successful prostitutes and resorted to violence to intimidate them, physically in many cases. And at the same time, women did not step back and accept it. They asserted their own rights as best they knew how, and that was oftentimes bringing cases to court to try and prosecute the various individuals. The part that the records are sometimes silent on is that it seems that many of these men were not severely punished in many cases. And that perhaps is, again, a reflection of who really held the mechanisms of power in regards to prostitution during the 19th century.
How do reformers come into the picture? Because, I mean, you know, it sounds like it's an ascendant arc, but somewhere around mid-century, you begin to have moral reformers decrying New York's prostitution, and they seem to enter and change the dynamic a lot.
Well, the reformers are always there. It's just that they're more vocal or visible at different points. As early as the 1830s, you do have moral reform societies appearing in New York. In fact, some of the first organized women's rights groups in New York appear out of their resentment or resistance to the visibility of prostitution and its de facto acceptance in the city. And there's a minister, a young Presbyterian minister by the name of John McDowell, who actually forms his own moral reform society and has his own newspaper called McDowell's Journal that he starts in the 1830s and threatens to advertise the names of the various clients. And his co-religious moral reformers actually shut him down and discouraged him because he is perceived as going too far, that the discussion of prostitution in McDowell's Journal is obscene and is defined that way. And his discussion is in what we would call today pornographic in the minds of many of his moral reform contemporaries. And then the moral reformers play a less visible role for much of the middle part of the century until after the Civil War, and then the famous or infamous, depending on your perspective, Anthony Comstock comes along, and with the help of the YMCA, establishes the Society for the Suppression of Vice, and he begins a moral crackdown, focusing primarily on obscenity, but he is involved in some effort to try and repress the most visible aspects of prostitution. And the different vice groups that form, however, have very little impact in terms of actually changing the behavior, changing the dynamics of prostitution in much of the 19th century. And it's really not until the Progressive period when reformers actually start to attack landlords and start to focus on property issues related to prostitution that they start to have an impact. And in fact, I don't think it's erroneous to describe the beginnings of the Progressive movement coming out of moral reform in New York, because it's Charles Parkhurst that first stands up there on the Madison Square Presbyterian Church pulpit one Sunday in 1893 and decries the visible prostitution that he's witnessed after being taken on a tour with one of his parishioners one evening, and that all of this is tolerated by Tammany Hall, and this is something that is associated with the corrupt political system of New York. And Parkhurst begins a reform campaign that over the course of the 1890s really coalesces into the progressive reform movement in New York, although his role in it becomes marginalized and the interest in prostitution becomes a little bit marginalized and taken over by other issues such as tenement house reform and child labor and the women's right to vote and other social issues of the time.
Well, let us step back a little bit to say, what were the connections between politics and the leisure districts, especially the illegal leisure districts, which were, you know, prostitution or gambling or Sunday drinking or boxing at one point?
The associations were multiple. For much of the 19th century, local politics was financed out of the revenues of illegal saloons, gambling dens, brothels, and many of the local ward bosses and local political figures had relationships with the proprietors of those kinds of institutions. And so there was a kind of cozy relationship, illegal but largely tolerated by local political officials and then again by the local police force. So, for example, if one wanted to open a brothel in the 19th century, one would first have to usually pay an initiation fee of anywhere from $50 to $100, usually increasing, of course, over the course of the century, to the local police captain. Police captains were political appointments, usually by the local political leader, usually somebody from Tammany Hall. And then they were expected to pay monthly fees, payoffs, what we would call today bribes, to the same political chief, and he would have his ward officer, as he was called, go around on a monthly basis, knocking on the door of the various brothels or illegal gambling dens or illegal saloons and extract the various payments from them. And so there was always a relationship between local politics at the ward level and prostitution and the kind of leisure economy that emerged during the course of the 19th century.
What are the key factors to the decline of visible prostitution?
Well, I think it's multiple. I think one is the changing social environment in New York. Immigration is halted with World War I beginning in 1914. So many of the social forces that's actually supplied the market, so to speak, that contributed to the large numbers of women that worked as prostitutes for short or long periods of time were effectively cut off. Progressive reform starts to, as I said before, make more serious headway in terms of fighting prostitution by focusing on landlords, of actually prosecuting landlords for tolerating the presence of prostitutes in their houses. The standard practice in the past had been that if a landlord if prostitution was discovered at a particular address, the landlord would always say he didn't know about it, or he was subleasing it to another landlord who then subleased it from him. That changes with injunction and abatement laws, the first of which are passed in the Midwest in the early part of the 19th century and then are adopted by New York and other cities. And so they start attacking landlords, and there's nothing better than better way to end prostitution or to change any kind of illegal activity than to attack the property owner, which is what they start to do. And ultimately, by the end of the 19-teens, 1919, 1920, there's lots of commentators that notice how difficult it is to find prostitutes in New York, that one has to know where they're located, one has to talk to cabs, one has to talk to the bellboy in the hotel if one wants to find the location of a brothel or where to go for that kind of activity. So, in effect, prostitution becomes much less visible, much more furtive, much more of an underground activity in the beginning of the 20th century, especially in the 1920s. And even technology plays a role in that the call girl appears during this time, where one can just call up and have someone come to your own residence or your own hotel room. And that perhaps is the biggest difference between prostitution in the 19th century and the 20th century, is that in the 19th century, the client went to the brothel, went to the prostitute, whereas in the 20th century, the prostitute, more often than not, comes to the client, usually in a hotel room or their own residence. And so the whole moral geography, the physical landscape of prostitution in the 20th century is completely different than what it would have been a century earlier.
In fact, you are in some ways a historical geographer, and so that lets us go to the big question. How applicable is or replicatable is the story you tell about New York to other times and venues? I mean, what can this model of prostitution tell us about prostitution and other societies?
Well, I think in the 19th century, this story would be repeated in many ways in other cities, and many of the same issues and phenomenon would be similar. I think each city is somewhat different. St. Louis experimented with legalized prostitution from 1871 to 1874, and New Orleans had Storyville from the late 1890s up to World War I, which is a unique story in and of itself. But I think for the most part, you would see very similar experiences in cities. I think it's a phenomenon that also is similar to a society going through significant change. In this case, the combined forces of urbanization and industrialization. And I hate to use those two terms because they basically can be used to explain almost anything in the 19th century. But the kind of prostitution that we saw in New York in the 19th century, you probably could find in some of the Asian countries today that are going through massive industrialization or massive social change as a result of the forces of their changing economies and rapid urbanization. So I think there's...
Surely the reformers, the anti-prostitution reformers, the worldwide ones, really do hold up like Thailand sex tours as
right.
Exactly that the model.
Right, right. And in part because you have large numbers of women that are being forced into cities, being forced off from their peasant backgrounds and rural areas into urban areas, and they're coming to the city with no skills, no opportunities, and they're literally being forced into prostitution to make a living. And there's organized networks that emerged. You hear the same terminology, in fact, white slavery, as it was described in the late 19th century, is being applied to the Asian countries as well, though we're not talking about white women in this case, but they're using the same kinds of images. So in that sense, I think there's a great deal of similarity between the two stories.
And let us turn away from prostitution now, friend. Let's go to your new project, which you said began with you found a diary of a pickpocket.
Right. I was in the course of doing the research on City of Eros. One of the subjects I wanted to get at, and I never was able to fully explore because the sources on this are virtually non-existent, but I wanted to learn more about that sporting male underworld, and I wanted to find sources that talked about the clients or that reflected the experience of clients and men that went to prostitutes. What was it that motivated them? How did it differ? Was it a function of age? Was it related to marriage? Or was it the cult of domesticity? And so I was going through some sources that I thought might have some kind of testimony in that regard, and I was the specific source was the Society for the Prevention of Crime Papers, which was a moral reform anti-crime organization that tended to focus more on drinking and illegal saloons, founded by another Presbyterian minister by the name of Crosby in the 1870s, and then was later taken over by Charles Parkhurst. And going through those papers, I came across a folder that was just a typed transcript, a typed manuscript, about 99 pages, and it was titled Autobiography of George Appo. And I started reading it, and I quickly realized that this was a first-hand account of growing up as a pickpocket and eventually moving into other kinds of criminal activity. And fortunately, he never says anything about prostitution in it, so I kind of put it aside and thought a little bit about it, kept it in the back of my mind. And when I was done with City of Eros, I went back to it because I was genuinely curious, in large part because it's one of the few first-hand accounts of what it was like to be a criminal, a pickpocket, an underworld figure in the 19th century. We have lots of first-hand accounts here in the 20th century, perhaps the best known being Nicholas Pileggi's Wise Guy, that eventually becomes the basis for Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas. But we don't really have any first-hand account from the 19th century. There's some published narratives, but they tend to be written with the help of moral reformers, and there's always a lesson, usually of Christian moral uplift, that pervades those published autobiographies. This story was never published. It was clearly written, I thought it was written by somebody else for him. He had dictated it to somebody, and that he never found an editor for, never found a publisher. And so he had worked. At the end of his life, he turned a new leaf, as they said, and he worked for the Society for the Prevention of Crime. And then eventually, somebody, I think, sat down and asked him to give this account, and it just got stuffed away in these papers. But it, as I said, presents this unusual firsthand account, and I'm using that text to look at various underworld subcultures. In this case, pickpocketing, because that's really what he starts out doing. Opium dens, because he becomes an opium addict. Prison life. He spends three terms in Sing Sing, one term in Eastern State Penitentiary. He's in the tombs at least eight different times. He's in Moyamensing Jail in Philadelphia. So he has a lot. He's on Blackwell's Island two different times in New York. So he's has a variety of prison experiences. And then he's also involved with a green goods confidence game, which was the most successful confidence game in late 19th century America. And so he touches on all these different elements of the 19th century underworld that I find fascinating. And so I'm using his life, his narrative, to look at various underworld subcultures.
And probably the most interesting of those underworld subcultures would be the prison subculture, mm-hmm. because we know so much of the later 20th century prison subcultures from popular culture prison movies, which grew out of prison protest literature in many ways.
Right, and the prison experience in the 19th century is much different than that in the 20th century in a variety of ways. In Appo's case, he actually goes through a multiplicity of prison experiences. There's no one single paradigm or experience that captures the prison experience for him. Even the three different times in Sing Sing, he has much different experiences. The first time, he's tortured several times. Literally within the first week, he has his teeth knocked out. He goes there when he's only 17 years old, and it's... He's, in his words, he's maimed for life when he leaves Sing Sing. The second and third time he comes back, he negotiates with the system a little better, and he accommodates, doesn't resist as much, and as a consequence has a much different kind of a prison experience. And most importantly, the biggest distinction between Sing Sing in the 1870s and 1880s with that of Sing Sing, say, a century later, or Sing Sing even today, is that there's very little power for the inmates. And I'm not saying that inmates have a great deal of power today, but inmates, by comparison, have much more control over their environment or much more of a say in negotiating their environment in the late 20th century than they did in the late 19th century. The guards had a great deal of control over them, and torture was quite commonplace in 19th century Sing Sing, and there was very little recourse the prisoners had. They had to walk in lockstep. They had to remain silent. They didn't enjoy some of the amenities such as TVs and libraries and recreation that they do today. They had to work in shops. I mean, Sing Sing, in fact, was really a big factory in much of the 19th century. It had at least 10 different factories at its height in the 1870s and the 1880s on the actual Sing Sing grounds, as well as a quarry. That's where they were chopping blocks at Sing Sing. Whereas you just don't have that kind of prison experience today. Furthermore, Apo goes through much different experiences when he goes to the Tombs, for example, the jail in New York, perhaps the most famous criminal barracks of the 19th century, where people come and go almost at will, and pickpockets actually are able to escape by picking the passes of people as they come in and out of prison. If visitors would come, for example, if you go to jail today, we've all seen it on TV where people sit behind a screen and there's a wall there or a glass and, you know, some place that someone can talk through. In the 19th century, the visitors actually went to the jail. They would go into the cell and talk with the prisoner. They would bring them food. They would bring them things to drink. And as you can imagine, they bring all kinds of contraband with them, the most convenient, of course, being liquor. But Sing Sing had no place, had no means to feed the inmates. So you actually had to bring the food into them, and they would eventually, a whole privatized system of feeding the inmates evolves during the course of the 19th century. So it's much more chaotic, much more of a situation where the inmates actually sometimes run the show. And that experience is completely different than what one would have experienced at Sing Sing or any other major penitentiary, and it's completely different from what you would experience today if you were to go to Rikers Island or California Avenue down in Chicago at the jail in Cook County.
Did Apo actually think that jail time or prison time was a cost of business? Did he look at it that way?
He never says that, but his behavior more or less indicates that it was. Had an attorney that he would hire when he got arrested. William Howe, interestingly enough, of the famous Hubbell and Howe fame, the best known criminal attorneys of the 19th century. He usually saw it as simply a part of doing business in the 19th century, as part of the kinds of activities in which he was involved. After the third time he's in Sing Sing, however, he does want to do something that's what he refers to as more of a sure thing graft, something that's less likely to get him thrown in jail, something that's more difficult for the police authorities to detect, and that's what ultimately gets him involved in the Green Goods confidence scheme. But for the most part, going to jail was part of the world in which he grew up. Apo himself is, I don't think, necessarily an unusual character. He's unusual in that he wrote an autobiography, but he grew up on the streets of Five Points. His mother was Irish. His dad was Chinese. His dad gets thrown in jail for murder when he's 4. His mother dies shortly thereafter. Never goes to school a day in his life. And is literally raised on the streets of New York, and eventually becomes a newsboy. And being a newsboy is how he learns how to pick people's pockets. He never, in fact, learned how to read until he went to Sing Sing. So Sing Sing, in many ways, is his school. And in that sense, I don't think that was unusual. And in fact, if you look at the Tombs, by the 1870s and the 1880s, the Tombs is processing, or at least the police courts of New York are processing, 80 to 90,000 people a year, which if you look at the censuses for 1870 and 1880, is 1 out of every 9 men in New York on an annual basis. Now, some of those are revolvers or repeaters, but if you consider that that's happening every year, evidence is that going through the prison system, going through the Tombs, going through the criminal justice process was a common working class experience, not something that just criminals or pickpockets or con artists would have experienced in the 19th century.
Much like black activists say today, for young black men in Washington, D.C., a stint in prison is a norm.
Right. It's almost a badge of honor. It's a rite of passage. And that's something that is by no means new. And in fact, one of the interesting things about prison when you start to look at it historically is that there's probably no other single public policy that has been historically proved time and time and time again to be a failure, yet no other alternative has replaced it. If we can look at, you know, going back to the work of David Rothman and Gerald Grobe and Michel Foucault in the 1970s and the 1980s regarding the movement of prison reform in the United States, to the work that's being done today with contemporary prisons and the large numbers of people in them. We have lots of evidence that prison simply doesn't do what it's supposed to do on a variety of levels. Yet we seem to be at a loss for finding some viable alternative to it.
Is that because we just want to punish people? And we know prison is harsh and bad?
I think it's probably a multiplicity of reasons. I think it's in some ways the easy way out. As citizens, we don't have to think about it as much if we just shove them into a prison. Out of sight, out of mind, I think plays a role in it. It used to be cheaper, although now it's clearly a very expensive proposition, but that also plays into the need for jobs. New York State has over 70 prisons now, many of them upstate, and many of them are the leading employers in their communities. And so that issue, the declining role of industry in upstate New York and the rise of the prison industry plays a role in their being seen as a viable alternative to lack of other forms of industrial employment. So I think there's multiple reasons as to why the prison system has continued to expand and grow more of a significant phenomenon, even though it's largely, in terms of public policy, in terms of rehabilitating or even adequately punishing people enough that they won't commit crimes again. Even in that venue, it's largely a failure because most of these guys go out and they're quickly back in again.
Well, you know, if prisons were a public policy failure, they don't punish, they just seem to house, and they seem to fill certain social needs. But you're essentially saying that prisons were, you know, they exist for the other reasons than what they are said to exist for.
Right. I think prisons have clearly failed in terms of their originally stated reformist goals, namely that of rehabilitating the inmates. But even in terms of the primary reason that most of the public, I think, supports prisons today, namely to punish and to deter criminals from committing crimes, even in that regard, they're largely a failure because there's so much recidivism. Many inmates go out and they immediately engage in the same kind of criminal activities that they did before. So even in that realm, they've largely failed to serve their purpose.
Yeah, and George Poe is typical. He's appropriate because he repeats his crimes. He does learn to do a different crime eventually, but you know that speaks to the failure of it. And
he graduates to other more successful, more entrepreneurial forms of crime over the course of his life.
And that really does kind of tell us that, you know, as an institution's prison failed, but they're really useful, and because you found the source, that we can actually get into the criminal subculture of late 19th and early 20th century New York.
So, exactly.
Timothy Guilfoyle, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.